Ah, the B-52 song, Rome, seems like the perfect song for our show today. We're going to learn a lot about our ability to find our way, or maybe not find our way, in the world with our guest today. Michael Bond is science writer, former senior editor at New Scientist. His work has appeared in Nature, Discover, the New York Times, and elsewhere, and he's authored several books, including the latest we'll be talking about today. It's titled From Here to There, The Art and Science of Finding and Losing Our Way. And Michael Bond with us by phone. Michael, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, man. When you talk about losing and finding our way, you're talking about it in a lot of senses, I think, not just a simple map and navigation sense. So talk about your book. What are some of the things you touch on in your book?
Well, I guess this idea started with the knowledge that navigation skills have been with us as human beings for tens of thousands of years, since early on in our evolutionary history. And there's lots of evidence that our early ancestors were expert navigators, able to find their way across the wide open spaces and remember where they'd been. So that's the idea that I started off with, and then looked at why there are such great differences in how people find their way today. I grew up in a family where I've got a sister who's really terrible at remembering where she's going, always getting lost, and then I've got a cousin who remembers everywhere she's been, even if she's been there only one time, and remembers it years later. So that sort of got me looking into just how we use those ancient navigation skills today, and why we all use them very differently, and some of us are better than others.
Well, I really enjoyed your book, and you talked to so many interesting people. What's that experience? What was it like interviewing so many interesting people, exploring all those different ways that we navigate in our lives?
Yeah, that was fascinating. I mean, partly I was interviewing scientists, psychologists, and neuroscientists who look at how people behave and look at what's going on in the brain when we go from A to B, and also people who study that in animals, in rats, and looking at the brain of a rat as it navigates around a maze. And then I was meeting a lot of people who are actually out in the world studying and being with people who are getting lost themselves, search and rescue volunteers who spend a lot of time tracking people who have gone astray off the beaten track. And so I was getting a really interesting picture from the sort of the fine grain, what's going on in the brain, to the more sort of macro idea of how people respond to the world as they're moving through it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading those experiences that you had with all of those people that you talked with. You know, and you mentioned earlier, like the early people had really good navigation skills. They could go dozens of miles to trade or just visit somebody and then turn around and go back and find their way.
I mean, there are still groups, communities of people who live that sort of ancient gatherer lifestyle, a nomadic lifestyle, and who these are groups in Africa or South America, Southeast Asia, and so we can get an idea from them how it would have been for all our ancestors 100, 200,000 years ago. And yes, so a typical behavior, I mean, these people tend to live in fairly small family units, but they would then travel for days, 100, 150 miles, just to visit a neighboring group to swap information or food resources, or knowledge about the environment, and then they turn around and walk back again. And to allow yourself to do that, you're going to have very good skills of spatial memory to be able to remember when you change direction and keep an idea of where your home is, because to be lost in those kind of environments is, you know, a very dangerous thing, which is probably why we needed these skills in the first place.
Yeah. And we may be losing those skills. You talk about some of the research done with children and their home range and how that's shrunk over time.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like any skill, navigation. It's you get better at it the more you do it. And if you grow up as a child being allowed to roam from home and being able to find your way as a child and to test your skills and have the confidence to roam and to get lost and know that you're gonna, you know, get found again, find your way back again. That's the sort of thing that translates into good navigation skills as an adult. And go back 50 years, and a lot of us would have been doing that anyway, being able to walk away from home and just explore like that. Children do that naturally. Children are really natural explorers. But now, of course, children are kept much closer to home for various fears. Well, I admit the main one is probably traffic, particularly if you live in a city or anywhere near a road. Parents are reluctant to allow their children to go anywhere near a road, and so that means children are very much more restricted than they used to be, and so less likely to exercise those navigation skills as they're growing up.
Yeah, and it's not a question of intelligence. You mentioned your sister, and your sister is pretty smart, but she just has trouble finding her way, apparently.
Yeah, it's really nothing to do with intelligence. I mean, the question of why some people are better than others, it has many answers. But I mean, where you grew up is one factor that has a big influence. So people who grew up in rural areas tend to be better than those who grew up in cities, simply because they're used to dealing with slightly complex environments. There are fewer straight lines in rural areas. The roads don't just go according to a grid system, whereas in a city they do. And so you don't have to exercise your brain as much in a city. You can remember to go left, right, left, and find your way. Whereas in the countryside, you need to exercise that part of your brain. And even cities that are more grid-like than others. If you live in a very grid-like city, you're going to be worse off than if you live in a city with more curved roads and one that's more complex. So the habitat in which you grow up is one important factor, but there are many others.
Yeah, I grew up in a rural area, and now I live in Madison, Wisconsin, which is bounded by four lakes. And so the roads are not in that grid pattern that characterizes so many cities. So maybe I'm a little better off. I don't know. Michelle in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I am an excellent navigator in an urban setting. But if I'm in a car driving somewhere, I could have driven there a dozen times and still be unsure if I know how to get there again. When we were traveling with a group through Europe, a multi-city tour bus, by the third, fourth city, people knew to follow me because I would be able to get them back to the bus. But in a car, I can't always find my way around.
So great on foot,
like,
but
a kinesthetic connection to my location or something?
Wow, what do you think, Michael?
Well, that's hi, Michelle. That's an interesting question, because if you're on foot, then you're much more in touch with your surroundings, and it's easier to pay attention, and you're going to have that spatial awareness. It's going to be much more visceral. If you're in a car, you're separated from that a little bit, so it's less easy to remember to pay attention. You know, those essential features of the environment are not as close to you as if you were on foot. The other thing, you mentioned driving in Europe. If you're driving in a place that's unfamiliar, especially, I mean, if you're driving on the side of the road that you're not used to, if the road signs are in a language that you're not fluent in, things like this can make you a little more anxious, a little more fearful. And anxiety and fear are one thing that always interferes with navigation skills and makes you less able to remember where you're going. So that could be one factor.
Yeah. Michelle, thanks for calling. Let's go to Ross in Middleton. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mike. My experience was I was in kind of a group of a bunch of different people, and it was sort of a competition, but a personal one, in which you were at a point. You had a topographic map and a compass, and then they would send you to find a small fence post about half a mile away, and that was just, you had to try to do this. And you'd look at the map, and you'd look at the lay of the land, and you'd think, well, I could see a swamp or some water or something, or there's like a hill. I think I'll just follow the topography and to get to this point, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't find this little fence post that would be hiding. And I'd come back, and at the end of the day, I was really frustrated. And this one guy says, stop trying to be a smarty pants with using the map. He goes, point your compass to where you want to go and know your pace count. And I think that was like my main thing is if people know how many steps it takes to walk 100 meters or 100 yards, or maybe do it by time. If you have a steady pace, it takes me, you know, say 5 minutes to walk. And then once I followed this guy's advice, the next day we went out and I would just point straight at it, which meant that I had to kind of go through the brambles, go up and down hills, and I would find my point. But pace count, I found, was sort of what allowed me to succeed in that situation.
Interesting. Michael, a comment?
Yeah, well, counting your paces, knowing how many paces, for example, will take you to go 100 meters. That's a great navigation skill to have, and all special forces trained to learn that. Search and rescue volunteers will know their pace count. So that's a really useful skill to have because it helps you when you've got a map. Now, pointing a compass and just heading in the direction you know you're meant to go in, that is one method, but that's not going to... It's going to get you into trouble sometimes because if that compass direction were to take you through a swamp, for example, you get to the swamp and you discover, oh, actually, I can't go straight there because I'll be in up to my neck. I'm going to have to take a diversion. Then you're going to want to know how to change your bearing and change it back again. Even better, to read your map for the topography and the natural features that it shows to enable you to get round that swamp. So as well as learning how to use a compass, ideally in the wilderness, you want to know how to read a map. And it's actually not surprising you find it hard if you haven't done it before because you've got to learn what the map symbols mean. And you know, it's one of those things, the more experience you have, the better you get.
Thanks, Ross, for calling. Appreciate it. Michael Bond, our guest today. He is the author of From Here to There, The Art and Science of Finding and Losing Our Way. Fascinating book. And Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. How good are you at finding your way? Is Larry Mueller here talking today with Michael Bond, author of From Here to There, The Art and Science of Finding and Losing Our Way. One of our earlier callers, I think, may have been using something that you sort of describe as toponyms in your book. Something we might not use, and not realize it?
So the toponym as well, this is really the ancient art of naming places in your neighborhood, in your landscape. And this is how, again, something that earlier people, before there were roads and road signs and things to help you, people would name places and remember those names. And if you name a place, particularly the toponym is really a descriptive name. So the name of the place would include some description of what the place looks like or where it is in relation to other places. One one example is a place that I know very well, where I grew up part of my childhood in Scotland. There's a place called Rock of the Birds, Craig Nan Yuan in Gaelic, and that is a rock that is it's a sort of large feature on a road, and it's had that name for centuries. And there are always birds around that rock, and presumably there always have been. I mean, we're talking big raptors, eagles, and this kind of thing. And that was that's a great way of being able to remember a place and know when you've got there.
Jan in Whitewater, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jan.
Hello. My parents were forever lost. And luckily, I think my old brother learned to read a map before he learned to read. They would head from Missouri to go to the Ozarks and end up in Michigan and be perfectly happy. One of the worst things they did was twice in Washington, D.C. and in Miami. We're going down the road, and my older brother goes, "Dad, why are there blue lights on the side of the road?" We were on the runway at the airport.
But they were always happy. They had to be always happy if they were going to the Ozarks and wind up in Michigan. Michael, comment on that?
Right. Well, I'm imagining that if they were getting lost and then, but they were happy about it, that they probably weren't aware that they were lost. Let me just backtrack there. You can be lost is really it obviously a comment on your relationship with your surrounding. If you're not where you think you should be, then you're lost. That's one definition. But really, people who are properly lost, that's an emotional state. If you're lost, that's a comment on your psychological relationship, really, with your surroundings. But I'm imagining, Jan, with your parents, they may have been not in the place they intended, but they weren't sort of psychologically lost in that way because they were happy to be wherever they were.
That's right. Jan, thanks for calling and sharing that. Wow, ending up on an airport runway. Steve in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Well, hello. So I was wondering if you've had any evidence that as humans evolved, that they once had the ability to magnetically locate, and whether there are subpopulations that still have this ability. And the reason I ask is that at one time I believed that I had that ability. For instance, I could be in a cave and I would know what direction I was facing with no outside inputs whatsoever. And I lost that ability very cataclysmically on a vacation to Flagstaff, Arizona when I was a young adult. And I was driving someplace and I had a terrible headache, and all of a sudden my wife said, "Why are you going this direction?" And my directions had gotten flipped almost 180 degrees. And now I don't have that ability anymore. So I was wondering, is that something that maybe like birds and other animals, that maybe we had at some time and that we've lost?
Interesting. Thanks, Steve. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I looked at this quite carefully, and I didn't find any convincing evidence that humans have ever had that magnetic sense. But that's not to say we didn't. There are certainly people out there who believe that we may have done. And, I mean, you can see how it might have been useful. However, the other thing to consider is that we have great memories, great ability to find our way through our visual spatial system. And in some ways, we didn't need that magnetic sense. Now, Steve, your example in a cave, okay, that's perhaps a situation where it could be useful, but there could be other reasons why you were good at doing that. You could have had a great ability to keep a track of your direction as you were going through that cave system. And why you've lost that, I can only speculate. But, I mean, there is a condition, a type of disorientation that people get where their world flips 180 degrees and what they think was ahead of them is behind them in relation to what's on either side. I don't know whether that has anything to do with what happened to you, but there are various possibilities.
You're sort of a little bit different, but you write about a guy, Blake Ross, who in one of the co-inventors of Firefox, has never visualized anything in his entire life.
Yeah. That
must be awful.
Yeah. Well, I imagine it must be awful. He has a fairly rare condition, which is normally associated with damage to a part of the brain called the hippocampus, where he can't retain a visual memory. So he can't bring into his mind an image of, for example, where he was on holiday or where he was last night. So it makes a lot of things very difficult. It makes navigation extremely difficult because you can't remember those visual scenes, but it also makes a lot of memory very, very difficult because you can't remember. If you can't remember places you've been in, it's difficult to remember anything about that event because memory is very much a spatial function. So that is, that sort of damage to the hippocampus. In fact, Blake Ross, I don't think he has that damage. He has something else, but he certainly has all those symptoms. That's something else that makes the ability to find your way very, very difficult.
Mike in Lake Mills, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm terrible with directions. I have the distinction of being the only person to ever get lost in my hometown of Kewaunee, which is less than 3,000 people and right on Lake Michigan. My daughter, unfortunately, also has this, whereas my wife and son are pretty good. A friend of mine referred to it as two types of direction finding in people. One sort of an internal grid, meaning good directions. The other one, sign and post or pillar and post, something where, for instance, I'll say, oh, I turn right by that tree and then left at the sign. And I wonder if Michael has some comments on those two systems.
Oh, I bet he does. Michael?
Right. Well, I mean, there are several ways to be a good navigator. Most people who are great navigators, they have this ability to look at where they are from a sort of bird's eye perspective and to think of distant landmarks in relation to each other. So you have a sense, you have a map in your head that enables you to take shortcuts. But another way of navigating is simply to develop a great memory, a systematic memory for knowing how far you've been in a certain direction and where you turn when you get there. And that system can be just as effective. Of course, it's much harder. It sounds like you use that system, and it's a lot harder to be an effective navigator in a place you've never been in before. Because you don't really have that ability to build up that spatial map that gives you the confidence to go across the landscape in a way you haven't before. So, I mean, it's interesting in your family that there's so much so many disparities there in ability, and especially if you all perhaps grew up in the same sort of environment, you might expect to have similar abilities. But there are other, I mean, there are some reasons in the brain that causes people not to be very good. You know, brain connectivity, the neurons, the networks that link one part of the brain to another may not be as connected in your brain. I'm, again, pure speculation, but there are several reasons why it could happen.
Mike, thanks. Chris in Evansville, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. I have a comment that relates really to a couple of previous callers. A gentleman called in talking about a sense of magnetism or magnetic energy. I seem to have the same thing. I've had this all my life. I always find metal objects, and I find them without seeing them. I find them because I feel them, if that makes sense. And I can be walking down a street with a friend or riding in a car or driving a car, and I get out, and without looking, I say, wait a minute, I feel something. And there will be a dime or a quarter or a piece of jewelry or something. So I have jars and jars of this stuff. I keep it because I guess it's kind of a phenomenon in my mind, and I just keep it. But I seem to never get lost. I always know where Magnetic North is. I always know the cardinal directions. So I do believe in that kind of sense that humans have some ability that maybe we had stronger in the past but have kind of lost.
Oh, interesting, Chris. Michael, a comment.
Well, I think you need to get yourself into a neuroscience laboratory and have someone look at what's going on, because it sounds very interesting. As I say, that it's a controversial question, and the evidence at the moment suggests we don't have an evolved ability to use the magnetic field in the way birds do. But that's not to say that individuals don't have some certain powers that haven't been recorded before. So I don't want to say anything else, really. It sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it does. Chris, thank you very much for calling. Mark in Sister Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a terrible time with learning dyslexia and text work, and even just kind of coolia, but when it comes to navigating people, I'm their go-to guy how to get from place to place. And my brother always said that my uncle had a built-in compass, and he used to travel back and forth to California in the wintertime, and he had no problem ever getting lost. And when I was in the Coast Guard, I understood navigation very well. And in doing our lat-longs and navigating by map coordinates and understanding how the compass works. So I was wondering if dyslexics have an ability as far as navigating that's better than other people or not. I just thought maybe I'd bring that up to you.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't hear completely. I think, Mark, you said you had dyspraxia or dyslexia, but I'll
dyslexia.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Okay. I think, yeah, there's absolutely no evidence that people who suffer from dyslexia or dyspraxia, in fact, have impaired navigation abilities. I think navigation skills use a different part of the brain. In fact, navigation, finding your way, uses several different parts of the brain. And the other thing about humans is that we're generally good at adapting. So if there's something that's holding you back in one part of your life, people often find a way of managing in a situation in which they need to survive. And navigation really is a survival skill. So it doesn't surprise me to learn that you're a good navigator, despite having dyslexia.
And there's a part of your brain. You talked about some research on taxi drivers in England, London, I think, who their brain is a little bit functions, gets parts of their brain, the hippocampus, get larger as they have to learn these thousands of streets.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the hippocampus, that's the spatial part of our brain. And as we exercise it in a spatial way, and taxi drivers in London, they spend 3 to 5 years learning the layout of tens of thousands of streets and how they connect up. So they have all that spatial information. As a result, that part of their hippocampus actually grows. And when they retire and they stop driving, that part of the hippocampus shrinks back down again. So which just goes to show that the, you know, that part of the brain, like all parts of the brain, respond to how we use it. And just worth sliding in a comment here about using a sat-nav. When you use a sat-nav in a way that just simply means you follow directions, then that's effectively bypassing the hippocampus. It's, in fact, experiments have shown it's completely inactive when we use sat-nav, and you're not likely to grow your spatial memory or use your spatial skills, navigation skills at all when you're using that kind of technology.
That GPS technology, yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you wonder about whether or not that's a good thing or not. Oh, man.
It's a good thing for a lot of people who find it very troublesome finding their way from
your sister.
From A to B. My sister, for one. Yeah.
Oh, man. Tom in Wausau. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I had to call in. You had a previous caller that was talking about how he could find, you know, the north, south, east, and west. And yep. He was driving, and he had a headache, and all of a sudden it was gone. I had a stroke about a little over 4 years ago, and I didn't know what was happening to me, but the thing that I had was a really bad headache. And the result of that stroke was that I lost significant sight, and I lost my sense of direction. I used to be able to do that too. And so I just wanted to call because if he did experience, you know, he could have had a minor stroke that affected that part of the brain that you guys are talking about, which is where I had the damage from my stroke.
Oh, Tom, thank you so much for calling. Michael, that's a possibility.
I'd love to ask you, Tom, whether the loss of, you said you lost your sense of direction. Do you think that's to do with the damage in your brain, or is it to do with your impaired vision makes it harder for you to assess direction and distance?
At first, I thought it was the loss of sight, and it's not like I'm completely black. I just have what's called a severe left field cut. But, you know, I still can see somewhat, and I still have trouble navigating, you know, even around Wausau. You know, I used to be able to hop in the car and just drive where I needed to go with, you know, not even thinking about it. And that's all gone for me. So the way I have to navigate now, like when I'm out walking or anything, is it's become very much, okay, I decide where north, south, east, and west is, and then I have to think my way through. You know, I know which direction I'm going, but it's much more structural, where before it was all, I could just do it.
Yeah.
Right, right. And that's the other way of doing it, to think your way through a landscape can be just as effective as if you have that map in your head.
I was hunting in the Shawamigan National Forest, many thousands of acres in Wisconsin, and I knew the area pretty well, but it was getting close to dark, and it started snowing really hard, and I knew I had to find, there was a blow-down tree that I knew would lead me out, and so I started walking, but I couldn't see the tree, and pretty soon I was walking downhill, and I knew I should be going uphill, and the snow was blowing hard, and I really got scared, and my tracks were filling up with snow, and I thought for a minute, and then I just followed my tracks back as far until I was able to actually see that tree. And that got me reoriented and out of there. But I can tell you, when you're in the middle of a forest like that, where you've got 2 miles at least before you'd hit a road, it's a scary, scary experience. You've had that experience as well, Michael.
Well, something a little like it. I was researching the tragic story of Geraldine Largay, who the hiker who got lost on the Appalachian Trail in 2013 and was never found. Well, she was never found alive. I tracked down to the place where she died, in fact, and her tent was found. And wandering around in the middle of that great forest, I managed to lose my bearings and lose the place I'd left my compass and GPS and everything. And for a few minutes, I definitely felt that fear, terror, really. I'd never felt it's anything terror. Like it. So, I appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure. Jeanette in Warren, Illinois. Hi, Jeanette.
Oh, I think Annette in Green Bay. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Annette? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I grew up in Germany in the 1970s, and when I moved to Appleton in the early or the late 70s, I had to get used to the whole north, south, east, west grid pattern. And it wasn't where there are avenues and streets and numbers, and they're just names. And in the residential areas, everything looked the same. All the corners were the same. And I had a hard time getting used to this grid pattern here in the United States. But eventually I got over it. But it seems like that's easy to get to know. But if you're in another country that doesn't have a grid pattern, it's really hard sometimes to figure out where you're at.
Comment, Michael.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you often think, well, okay, a grid pattern, that makes things pretty easy to navigate, because all you have to do is remember where to turn left and right and how many blocks to travel. But, of course, it makes everything very much look the same. And, you know, if every junction is a right angle and there aren't any particularly distinguishing features about the roads, then it does make everything quite uniform, and that's not helpful when you're navigating a place. You want to be able to distinguish different features to allow you to remember, to allow you to sort of have variety in your mental map. So sure, that stands to reason. I imagine you found a way of adapting to it, though.
It's really easy, and I think I have a bit of a good sense of direction. The only thing I wonder sometimes is being a left-handed person, is that kind of a detriment sometimes? Because I left and right mixed up quite a bit. And I is that a left-handed trait?
Well, is that a left-handed trait?
Yeah, that's something that I know a team of psychologists is testing for right now in a lab in London, as to whether people who are left-handed have any kind of advantage. The one thing I know is that certain search and rescue volunteers and trackers who I've spoken to believe that left-handed people behave differently to right-handed people when they're in an environment that they don't know. So they might turn left or right at a barrier or at a junction, depending on whether they're left or right-handed. But at the moment, it hasn't been scientifically tested.
Oh. Well, Michael, this has been fascinating talking with you today, and we haven't covered a lot of the book. There's so much more in your book, and I really want to thank you for writing it. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I know, I hope you sell a lot of copies. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Larry. I've really, really enjoyed the discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great. Michael Bond, a science writer, former senior editor at New Science. His book is titled From Here to There, The Art and Science of Finding and Losing Our Way. And it is very entertaining and thought-provoking as well. So I hope you have a chance to take a look at the book. It's a fascinating book. Well, you know, most of us like treasure hunts. I mean, I do. I hope you do. And especially when there's always more treasure to be found. We're going to be talking about geocaching next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mailer.